All right, I'm going to continue this discussion of healthcare. In this lecture, I'm going to raise the possibility that what is going on in healthcare in the United States could be called a crisis of abundance. Now, typically, a crisis in healthcare would be a shortage of healthcare. That is, there's just not enough, and people are dying or suffering because they can't get to the doctor, they can't get the care they need. And what I want to suggest is that a lot of the problems that people are talking about in healthcare almost reflect the opposite. They reflect an abundance. For example, a point that's very prominent about healthcare is the huge increase in the United States in the share of our gross domestic product that we devote to healthcare. That is, we put a lot more of our income into healthcare than we did 25 years ago. In 1980, U.S. healthcare spending took up 8%, 8.7% of GDP. Other industrial countries were in the 6 to 9% range. So what that means is the United States was in the upper end of the range, but we were not the country that devoted the absolute most to healthcare spending. I believe Denmark and one other country at that time spent more than we did. But we were in the upper end of the range, but we weren't ridiculously outside the range. Now flash forward over 20 years. In 2002, the U.S. was spending 14.6% of GDP on healthcare, and it's over 15% today. Other countries, meanwhile, although they'd seen some increase, it wasn't nearly as dramatic, and so they were in the 8 to 11% range. So now the United States is just way outside the norm for industrial countries in terms of how much we spend how much we spend on of our GDP on healthcare. In dollar terms, we spend $5,000 per person per year on healthcare, compared with $3,000 per person per year in other industrial countries. So that's a big difference in dollar terms. The impact of this is that, first of all, Medicare and Medicaid budgets are strained. Medicaid is growing rapidly in state budgets. They're having to cut back elsewhere in order to be able to fund Medicaid. So they're either having to raise taxes or cut support for education or other things so that they can keep up with Medicaid. Medicare is growing very rapidly. I think it already is to the point where the Medicare taxes are not sufficient to cover Medicare spending. So, I mean, if you think Social Security is bad, Social Security, at least, for the moment, the taxes are more than enough to cover the benefits are being paid out. Now, in a few years, it's going to go into deficit, but Medicare is already in deficit. That is, there's already more in Medicare benefits being paid out than the taxes coming in, and that's going to get much worse very rapidly. So, government spending on healthcare is shooting up. Meanwhile, our traditional employer-provided health insurance system is deteriorating. Companies are trying to cut back benefits. Companies are cutting back on take-home pay to workers because they're paying out more in health benefits. And the whole system is sort of messed up because as workers change jobs, they get different health insurance or they lose health insurance. And we're in a very dynamic economy where you don't spend your whole life working for the same employer. And because of that, because of these frequent changes, there's less benefit to society of tying health insurance to the employer because people just aren't staying with the same employer for as long as was the case in the 1950s. And then you have a lot of people who are self-employed nowadays, and they, of course, don't have employer-provided health insurance, and so the system doesn't work for them. And then, so as a consequence of all these things, you have millions of people who are uninsured, a lot of them with very high incomes, but they choose not to get health insurance because they see sticker shock in terms of what it would cost to go out and obtain their own health insurance. So those are some of the impacts of the sort of the high levels of health spending. All right, so I want to talk about some of the common scapegoats. And I use the term scapegoat because I don't think these are really the problem. People like to blame these things. That's kind of the definition of a scapegoat, is you blame something that is not really the problem. One of them is drug companies. People are upset that the drug companies make a lot of money, but drug company profits are less than 3% of total healthcare spending. So if you eliminated all drug company profits and somehow kept everything else going the same way, 97% of healthcare spending would still be there. And of course, you eliminate drug company profits, and at some point you eliminate drug companies. They're not going to keep developing drugs and keep doing research if they're not making any money at it. So it's certainly unrealistic to get rid of all drug company profits. So that's not really a solution. Next, you have malpractice insurance. People say that the lawyers who go after doctors and sue them are causing all sorts of problems, and they're raising costs and so on. But it's hard to demonstrate any significant impact of that. Again, malpractice claims and malpractice insurance also show up as being pretty small relative to total healthcare spending. Some people like to blame private insurance companies. They say there's way too much overhead. And certainly, people who go to the doctor and go through all the process of filing insurance claims know what that, they can see that overhead every day. But the overhead is less than 8% of healthcare spending. And so you really can't blame insurance companies for the huge increase in spending over the last 20, 25 years in the United States. So another scapegoat is spending on the last year of life. Sometimes people will assert that it's, half of what healthcare goes in the last year of life. But the best data that we have say otherwise. It says it's probably on the order of about 7% of total healthcare spending. And I think if you think about it, it's probably pretty hard to eliminate spending on the last year of life. When people say that we waste money on the last year of life, you get the picture of doctors hovering around these terminally ill patients, giving them all sorts of surgeries and procedures in a futile attempt to save their lives. But actually, the reason that there's a lot of spending in the last year of life is that as people approach death, especially the way they die nowadays, they deteriorate and they need a lot of care. I mean, it was one thing in the old days when people died of infectious diseases, before there were antibiotics and stuff. If someone dies at age 25 from typhoid or some other infectious disease, it takes them quickly, and there's not much that medicine does about it, so there's not much spending in the last year of life. Now go to something like today. If someone dies of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, they're going to spend part of their life totally dependent, unable to care for themselves, requiring nursing care, nursing home care, things like that. So you're bound to see a lot of spending near the last year of life, given the way people die nowadays. Okay, so now that I've talked about the scapegoats and how that they're not a big part of the problem, and that we can't do much about spending, and we shouldn't want to try to do much about spending by attacking those scapegoats. Let me talk about what I think really is causing the big rise in medical expenditures. The first thing I want to show is how specialization in medicine is rising. Okay, overall, between 1975 and 2002, the U.S. population rose 35%. The number of doctors, meanwhile, more than doubled. It went up 111%. So we added doctors to the population, relative to the population. We increased the physician to person ratio, and that's certainly going to increase healthcare spending, healthcare utilization. But more importantly, look at the way that we increased physicians. If you look at general practitioners, up 55%. General all-purpose surgeons up only 26%. So that's relatively small. But the specialists, like internal medicine, pediatrics isn't too much of a specialty. That could be lumped in with general practice. But then you get to cardiovascular, gastroenterology. So we double the number of cardiovascular doctors. We quadruple the number of gastroenterologists. Quadruple, more than quadruple pulmonary. Almost quadruple the number of neurologists, 7 times the number of diagnostic radiologists. So we've got a more specialized workforce. The specialists are more expensive, and they're more of an add-on. So it's not just you're going to the doctor, but now you go to the doctor and you get referred to the specialist. So you pay the doctor, you also pay the specialist, and the specialists are even more expensive than the doctor. So that's one component of what I call premium medicine. The other component is technology. For example, in 1980, there were only 3.6 million CAT scans done for the entire United States population. In 2003, there were over 50 million done. In 1980, there were no MRIs because MRI didn't exist. In 2003, there were 24 million MRIs done. So we're doing this huge number of CT, CAT scans, huge number of MRIs, and just in general, medical technology is constantly changing. If you go to a doctor's office today, it would be really interesting to look if we could get a film of a typical doctor's office, a videotape of a typical doctor's office, let's say in 1970, 1975, and then compare it today. I think you'd see all sorts of gadgets and devices in the doctor's office that you wouldn't have seen 30, 35 years ago. This medical technology is constantly coming on stream, and we're using it. So to use some economic jargon, medicine now employs a lot more human capital and a lot more physical capital. Human capital meaning the specialized knowledge that doctors have developed. So doctors today know a lot more than they did 30 years ago, but we pay for that knowledge because they need more training, and ultimately we need to compensate them for the additional training and study that they do, and the specialization that they do. So that's the human capital aspect of premium medicine. And then the physical capital aspect is represented by things like CAT scanners, MRI machines, and then all the other gadgets that now occupy physicians' offices and hospitals. There's just a lot more technology, which is a lot more capital being thrown at medicine. So what we're doing today that we more than what we did 30, 35 years ago is consuming a very capital-intensive form of medicine. Physical capital in the form of MRIs, CAT scanners, other devices, and then human capital in the form of greater medical specialization. So what we're doing is we're consuming nowadays a very expensive mix of medical services, and I call that premium medicine. And it's that premium medicine that's driving up the share of GDP that we're devoting to healthcare. Now, is it the worst thing in the world that we're devoting more of our GDP to healthcare? That's a big question, because you could say, well, what else would you spend your money on if you weren't spending on healthcare? Would you be spending on entertainment? Would you be spending it on big cars? I mean, healthcare is not necessarily the worst thing to be spending money on. But given the huge increase in spending on GDP, a natural question to ask is, are we better off? I mean, is this is premium medicine worth the price that we're paying for it? And we get, I think, a very mixed set of answers to that question. If you look over time, you compare how things are today with how they were 25, 30 years ago, and so on, what you can see is that we have definitely had an increase in longevity. People live longer now than they did in the past. We also see improved health among the elderly. 30 or 40 years ago, people in their 60s would have several chronic illnesses, several debilitating illnesses. Now, people in their 60s can be quite spry. They can be quite healthy. They can be running marathons. They can be traveling around the world. They can be not retiring, very ready to work and so on. And in fact, across the population at large, we've reduced chronic illness, at least for a given age rate. That is, the typical 40-year-old today is healthier than the typical 40-year-old 30 years ago. The typical 70-year-old today is healthier than the typical 70-year-old 30 years ago, and so on. So we see all those things going on over time. But that could be a combination of things. It could be easier working conditions. There are probably fewer people working on factory floors doing hard physical labor, so that makes it easier to remain healthy. There are fewer people working with dangerous materials. That makes it easier to be healthy. So, well, the point of that is that there are more factors beyond just healthcare that may account for this improvement that we've seen over time. But some of it probably does reflect healthcare. Another sign that we are better off because of healthcare is that there are lots of specific treatments that have been studied, and by the Food and Drug Administration or some other people, but generally the Food and Drug Administration, doing statistical tests, careful controlled experiments, and seeing that these specific treatments have proven success. For example, beta blockers have definitely reduced heart attacks. Finally, other evidence that things that we're better off comes from anecdotes of successful interventions. I recall one story of a patient who was sent for an MRI for back pain, and the MRI ended up finding cancer, and the cancer was caught just in time and cured. So it's not the case that all these MRIs are wasted, although I think probably a huge number of them are. So those are all types of good news. That is, we definitely have gotten healthier over time, although it's hard to pin that specifically to all this spending on healthcare. We do see some specific treatments that have been studied carefully that show that we're better off, and we do see anecdotes of successful uses of premium medicine. On the other hand, on the downside, it seems like every comparison of populations, comparison in different states in the U.S., comparison of the U.S. with similar populations in other countries, seems to show that there's no difference in results from receiving more premium medicine. So, if you look at states where people with particular conditions receive a lot of medical care versus states where the amount that's spent on them is less, you don't see dramatically different results, and that's certainly worrying. A source of concern. And every international comparison fails to show a dramatic increase in healthcare results for the United States compared to other countries, even though we clearly spend much more on healthcare. So, those are, in statistical terms, those are called cross-section studies, these comparisons of populations in different locations. And those cross-section studies are very disturbing because They don't show results. Another thing that people do, they'll look at the health of people in relation to, let's say, the supply of cardiologists in two different states, and again, not see a difference. And that's you would think that you would see a difference. Another source of concern is that there's some evidence that medical services that people get are determined by supply and availability, not by proven value. So you will see things like, if after someone has had some kind of intervention for a heart problem, someone discovered a heart murmur, or somebody actually had heart surgery, the extent to which they're followed up afterward seems to depend more on the cardiologist's schedule. So in areas where cardiologists are really busy, the follow-up visits might be once every 6 months or once a year. In areas where the cardiologists are not so busy, the follow-up visits will be once every 3 months or once a month. And that's sort of disturbing, because you would think that the follow-up visits would be determined by the nature of the illness and some proven study of how often people need to be followed up for the particular heart problem, rather than just, these physicians have time to see patients frequently and those physicians don't. So that's a source of concern. It appears that other countries control spending through a combination of reduced availability and different cultural expectations. Some countries, such as Canada and Great Britain, determine the supply of health resources nationally. There's a national health care budget, and so that way they can control how much gets spent on MRIs or specialists or things like that. So, for example, in Canada, there are not enough trained specialists, and there's not enough equipment to do routine colonoscopy. Routine colonoscopy is recommended for people over 50, getting a colonoscopy about once every 5 or 10 years as a way of preventing colon cancer. It's got a very high success rate in doing that, in preventing colon cancer. And colon cancer is, I think, the third biggest killer of all the cancers. So colonoscopy is very valuable, but it's also very expensive. And Canada, people over 50 typically do not get this colonoscopy, so presumably they're more likely to get colon cancer and more likely to die of colon cancer than people in the United States. And that's an issue of the government just not budgeting the money. In the United States, you don't have to worry about the government budgeting the money. As long as there's insurance money or people are willing to pay out of their own pocket, the fact that people are willing to pay for this stuff induces the supply. It's just a regular market response. If people are willing to pay for something, then the supply will be there. It isn't rationed by the government. Great Britain also does government rationing. Other countries might have a lot of government support for spending, but they don't have the government budget to say what the supply will be. In terms of the United States, that's closer to the way Medicare operates. That is, the government will pay for services under Medicare. The government does not turn around and say, well, there are only going to be this many doctors, there's only going to be this many MRI machines. They just let that be determined by the market. They help, they'll pay for the services, but they don't turn around and dictate how much services there will be. And a lot of other countries, even though they have government paying for a much higher share, like 70 to 80% of healthcare spending, as opposed to only 40 to 50% in the United States, they don't impose the budget constraints. And so the question is then, how do they keep from spending so much on GDP? And I think they just have different cultural expectations. I think that in other countries, there's not, they don't expect to receive as much premium medicine. In the United States, people, as consumers, they want They want answers, they want them definitive, and they want them now. They expect their doctors to be perfect. They expect doctors to come up with a diagnosis, come up with a cure, and they expect it qu everything to happen quickly. And so I think in other countries, maybe the cultural expectations are not quite so high, so that the demand for premium medicine is not as high in other countries. But I haven't done thorough research to actually demonstrate that. So let me summarize everything so far. So a key point is that the U.S. spends much more than we did 25 years ago on healthcare, and we spend more than other countries do on healthcare. The evidence is somewhat mixed as to whether we're getting our money's worth. There's some evidence that suggests that we do have very good healthcare and good health outcomes. There's other evidence that might contradict that. The main cause of our higher spending is our what I call the capital-intensive mix of healthcare services, what I call premium medicine. And it's capital-intensive in that it uses lots of high-tech equipment, and it uses a lot of what's called human capital, that is, specialists, people with who've acquired a lot of skills and training in medical services. And so when we ask whether we're getting our money's worth, what we're really asking is this capital-intensive mix of healthcare worth what we're paying for, paying to get it? And that's a very difficult question to answer. And as I said, the best we can say now is that there are mixed results. There's some evidence that says we're getting our money's worth, and there's other evidence that raises questions as to whether we're seeing sufficiently better health outcomes in the United States to justify this enormous gap between what we spend and what we on healthcare and what we used to spend, and between what we spend and what other countries spend on healthcare.